From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're still smarting from the Leviathan-like images from the Gulf of Mexico and the Deepwater Horizon explosion and oil spill disaster. But the hunger for energy is deep. We're going for shale oil in North Dakota and fracking all over. Now we're tiptoeing into the treacherous Arctic, north of Alaska, for the biggest energy prize of all. But since a fancy, supposedly Arctic-proof big oil rig broke loose and ran aground a few days ago, people are getting spooked all over again. This hour on Point, the mighty oil rig Kulik, literally on the rocks, and the future of oil drilling in the Arctic. Severe weather, complicated efforts to assess the damage to Shell's drilling platform, the Kulik. It was grounded off near Kodiak Island on Monday. A little better weather there lately. Here on Monday, CBS News' Lee Cowan reported on attempted rescue operations.
The concern is not for the crew. All 18 aboard were evacuated by the Coast Guard. The worry is the more than 160,000 gallons of diesel fuel and oil locked deep in the rig's hull, all being relentlessly battered by waves as high as four-story buildings.
Four-story buildings there, 70-knot winds, waves up to 50 feet, we read here in some sources. With us first today from Alaska, from Anchorage, Rich Maurer, reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. Rich, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome, Tom. Good to be here.
So here we are. We're talking about Arctic drilling, but this rig is not in the Arctic. It was being towed by what to where when this happened, Rich?
Well, actually, yeah, it was far from the Arctic. Yeah. It was being towed through normal shipping channels where there's just ships going through all the time. It was being towed from Dutch Harbor, where its port was right after it came back from the drilling season, and it was being towed to the Seattle area for winter repairs.
So here we've got a great big tugboat, and we've got a great big rig, and it's normal sailing channels, but pretty rough weather. What happened last week, Rich?
Well, it's a very slow journey. It makes about 4 knots, which means it's going to take about 4 weeks to get to Seattle. As they were pulling it, obviously you leave Dutch Harbor, and it's a 4 week journey. You have no idea what the weather's going to be like after about a week or so.
Right.
They were staying fairly near the shore, and they hit this one of these humongous winter storms. Nothing completely out of the ordinary. And one of the lines, this would have been Thursday of last week, a week ago, one of the lines broke between the Kulik, the drilling rig,
yep,
and the Ivik, the specially built tow ship. And there was another line. They quickly got that readied. And then there were four engines on the Ivik, and all of them died. And so they were adrift for a while. Big Coast Guard came out there.
And this is the tug that's supposed to be, I mean, there's no propulsion on the rig, so it's all about the tug, and even its engines died.
Absolutely. And finally, they got one of the engines partially restarted. They were able to kind of hold their position. A bunch of other ships were called in for an emergency. They got several other tows on there. A big tug that's normally stationed in Valdez after the Exxon Valdez disaster.
Sure.
Came out there, and it's a tough tug, and they got a line on it, and the AVIC finally was going, the tug, the alert from Valdez was pulling it, and the storms just kept up. They shouldn't have been, at that point, they had been trying to get to safe harbor. They were still stuck in the North Pacific and the Gulf of Alaska, and they had to let go. The alert, the Valdez tug, its engine started overheating. They had to drop the tow. And this would have been Monday night. They cut the lines, and it washed up on a beach, near a beach. It's about 500 feet offshore, south of Kodiak Island.
I mean, it's so big that at this scale, I guess you call that on the rocks. That's about as close as it could get. This rig can have 100-plus crew members on it when it's up doing its work. There were only 18. When and how were they taken off the rig, Rich?
Correct. They were. It was some one of these wild Coast Guard rescues. They flew a helicopter over it, and in those giant seas you were talking about, probably not quite 50 feet. It was in the 30s, but that's still wild. And huge wind, and they plucked them off one by one. So basically made it a situation where The worst case scenario is the drill rig breaks up and its fuel spills, but no one, no human life is lost.
And that's about 150,000 gallons, we read here, of diesel and other lubricants on this rig. I mean, that's not on your Valdez scale at all. Still, I mean, the thing that has people scratching their head is, with the stakes so high and Shell so eager to drill in the Arctic, you'd think they'd have things just buttoned up to a fare-thee-well, and here it's in regular shipping lanes. Just 50 miles, I'm reading here, Rich, from the big Coast Guard station there, Kodiak. If they were 1,000 miles north and something like this happened in the Chukchi or the Beaufort in the Arctic, they would not have that nearby Coast Guard help to come and help out, would they?
That's correct, and they wouldn't have the tug from Valdez. I mean, there's a lot of things that they wouldn't have up there, especially, you know, given the current state of the Arctic, which is just starting to open up because of climate change, as we know.
So what are people in Anchorage saying, thinking about Shell Oil's future in the Arctic? They've had a series of mishaps and some violations cited by the Coast Guard. They were up there doing some fairly shallow drilling this summer, but they had hoped to go forward and did not. What's the future look like, Rich?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of different ideas in Anchorage, which probably differs a little bit than from the rest of the country in oil development. But I think people are concerned that Shell is not living up to its PR, and there's been, as you said, this is the worst of several incidents. There was another drill rig had a fire. There's been some permit issues, questions about readiness. So this is not the only issue by far.
Rich Maurer with the Anchorage Daily News, joining us today from Anchorage in Alaska, early in the day up there. Rich, we appreciate your coming on. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks.
Let's turn to Shell. Curtis Smith joins us right now, also from Anchorage, Alaska. He handles external affairs for Shell Alaska. Curtis Smith, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What's your hope for how this grounding of the Kulik would be resolved, Curtis?
Well, I'm going to have to start with priorities, Tom. I mean, really, our priorities start with the safety of the responders who are not only on scene now, but the responders really that have been part of this process, this incident, for the last 5 days.
It must have been brutal out there.
There were very, very severe storms, one after another, and they have performed remarkably in those conditions, and our hats off to all of them. We're so appreciative, but we want to make sure that they get home safely from this incident. Of course, the environment as well.
Absolutely. And that depends on the rig. So do you see the rig breaking up? Do you think you can save it or not?
Well, it's too early to say, and of course, I'm not an expert. I'm looking at the same pictures that you are, Tom, the same pictures that have been released. And as you probably saw, the rescue teams, or I should say recovery teams, did actually get on the rig yesterday.
Yeah, five guys to check it out, and it's unbelievably close to the island there. I mean, that's huge rig right by the shore. You think, oh, my gosh. What's the word?
Well, the word is the fuel tanks look intact. And, of course, that's very good news in terms of the local environment there, the coastline. We're going to get a better look, we hope, today from those recovery teams as they look into the bowels of the Kulik to see if there's truly is integrity to the hull, which they believe there is. But, again, we can't know that for sure until they take a closer look.
Question that gets raised in this circumstance, if we can't count on Shell's expertise to keep its rig safe on an ordinary, you know, just being tugged south in fairly normal sailing lanes, how can we count on Shell to keep its drilling safe? We've all got Deepwater Horizon images in our minds. If it were up in the Arctic, you know, plugged into a big old vein of oil under the seafloor.
You know, those concerns are, of course, things that we hear a lot. And they're good conversations to have, and we're, of course, willing to have them. I want to start with the incident itself. You talked about normal shipping lanes, and, of course, they are. Thousands of ships, freighters, cargo, and otherwise move through there every year. But in this particular instance, of course, a series of what we think are unlikely events compounded over a short period of time, underscored by what Mr. Maurer talked about, which was a complete inexplicable loss of power to the propulsion engines on the Ivik.
We hear all that, and we accept that, Curtis. But, of course, things do come together. Here the stakes are fairly low compared to if you were plugged into the ocean floor in an oil well. But if they can come together in a way this challenging there, And with the mishaps you've seen in the Arctic, what should give us confidence that Shell can safely drill up there?
Well, I'm going to have to go back to our history in the Arctic. I don't know if you're aware, but Shell has a very long, successful history of drilling offshore Alaska. So that informs our confidence that we can do this safely and responsibly. Our 2012 season, you talked about mishaps, but really there were several days of drilling that made no news. And so that also informs our confidence that we can do this right. But I want to stop there because in light of this incident and any others, when something goes wrong operationally and it's not flawless as we expect or plan or want it to be, we have to own that and we have to learn from that, and we will.
Curtis Smith with Shell Oil, external affairs guy there in Anchorage, Alaska. We're going to dig on in here, but we're grateful to you for joining us for a few minutes today. Thanks so much, Curtis, for being here.
You bet. Thank you, Tom.
Here's the sound of what you do not want to hear in the Arctic Ocean. This is April 20th, 2010. Explosion on the Deepwater Horizon killed 11 men, injured 17 others before the wellhead was capped. 3 months later, nearly 5 million barrels of crude oil had gushed out into the Gulf of Mexico. This is ABC's Jeffrey Kaufman flying over the spill soon after the rig sank to survey the damage.
After it sank, there was a slick 5 miles long. Today, that slick is 12 miles long, covering 100 square miles.
The problem? The winds are coming from the south, and they're strong, about 30 miles an hour, pushing that oil north towards the coast.
We saw where it's headed if it makes land. Fragile oyster fisheries and a bird sanctuary in the Mississippi Delta.
That was the Deepwater Horizon going down in 2010. Nobody wants to see that in the Arctic, but of course, the circumstances there can be far more extreme than in the Gulf of Mexico. Let's go down to real oil country. Not that Alaska isn't. It certainly is and has been. But John Sullivan joins us right now from Houston. He's senior reporter for the Energy Intelligence, covers offshore drilling for the paper, including in Alaska. John, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me on your program.
It's great to have you here. There's an awful lot of oil and natural gas up under the Arctic. Shell is the one who's looking at it north of Alaska, poking up there this last summer. How's that been going so far, John, from an oil biz perspective?
Well, Shell has run into some just, I believe the gentleman who was speaking before me said inexplicable, and I think that's the best word for it. They've just run into some incredibly strange problems. They show up at the drill site and late-season ice shows up, so they have to leave the drill site. One of their key vessels is not ready, so they can't actually begin drilling. They were able to do what's known as top-hole drilling, which is basically to get the well started, but they can't drill very deep. So it has been kind of a year of missteps for a company that has an incredible safety record.
What happened with the containment dome that they had up there, John, this great big dome that they would put over a well if it got in trouble? What happened there?
There was a test, a dockside test, that was something happened in the containment dome, wound up getting damaged in the dockside test, so they weren't able to use it.
I mean, it just slipped off and kind of flipped away from where it was supposed to land on the bottom, right? It just got away from them.
It kind of got away from them. And again, it's one of those things that you just don't expect to happen.
Now, there's a sister rig that has been working up there alongside the Kulik, which is grounded right now near Kodiak Island. That's the other rig is the Noble Discoverer, and it pulled anchor and ran aground this summer in Dutch Harbor, I think, right, in the Aleutians.
Yes, it did. The Noble, but there is a big difference, though. The Kulik is a drilling rig, and the Noble Discoverer is a drill ship. It's a self-contained vessel with the drilling rig on it. And in Dutch Harbor, it's my understanding that a storm came up, and it got basically drug across the harbor and almost beached itself before they gained power and was able to bring it under control. After everything was over, they did go out to the drilling site and came back. There was a small fire in the engine room. So, again, it's just this kind of wave of little incidents that have happened that just are kind of kind of strange, to be honest with you.
Now, there's a big prize up there. I'm looking here at a U.S. Geological Survey, 08, says the Arctic may hold 90 billion barrels of oil, 1,669 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. That's maybe 13% of the world's remaining oil, maybe 30% of the world's remaining gas. That's gigantic. The U.S. and Canada, Greenland have a lot of the oil. Is it only Shell that's been poking up there so far, John, and why only Shell?
Actually, other countries
have. I mean, in the U.S., I should say.
In the U.S., Shell has been the only one so far. They're kind of leading the way. They're kind of the pathfinders in this deal. But other companies have delayed because of what's happened up there. Total, the French energy company, has delayed its drilling efforts until at least 2014. And then there's not a guarantee that they're actually going to drill. So a lot of companies are watching this to see what happens and to see if the risk and the rewards kind of equal each other out.
What's it look like around the rim of the Arctic? Norway, Russia, what are they doing in terms of drilling? Do you know at this point, John?
I don't know what Russia is doing. I know that there have been several drilling projects initiated by the Russians. There's a move by some of the Arctic nations to expand their Arctic frontiers through the United Nations. Russia is laying claim to some very huge amounts of territory that up until now had been considered open water. So there are moves. A lot of countries, I believe, understand the potential rewards up there. But at the same time, they're looking at what's going on with Shell and seeing some of the potential risk.
Shell has spent $4.5 billion on permits and equipment and personnel over 6 years to get in there. Is it, do you think, inevitable that they'll have offshore rigs in the Arctic, off Alaska, doing this work or not?
Now, that is an interesting question. If I had the complete answer to that, I could probably be making more money. I think eventually, yes, we will. Will it require new technologies, new drilling technologies, new systems? Probably. The Arctic Technology Conference was just held here in Houston about a month or so ago.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the presentations that was very widely viewed was one where a German company came up with the idea of using submarines as drilling rigs, as supply vessels, as floating storage and production facilities.
So they could go under the ice? Is that why? Or stay away from the weather? Why submarines?
Both. To stay away from the surface weather and to go under the ice.
Wow, submarine. I mean, is that economically feasible? Can you imagine that? It's, talk about extremes.
Well, the gentleman who was making the presentation was saying that if it wasn't economical, he wouldn't have been there. He said that the technology is sound. It's one aspect of what people are looking at when they're viewing the Arctic. So there's a lot of different things being put into play and a lot of different ideas that people are looking at.
Extreme measures to get to get into an extreme environment there. Shell's supposed to be sort of top shelf when it comes to this, but I'm looking here at a list of quite a few violations, discrepancies, serious ones the Coast Guard said they were cited for in this last season. What's that about? Why wouldn't it all be buttoned up?
I wish I had that answer, because Shell has a among the industry and an excellent record. You know, if you want to kind of watch things get done right, you watch Shell do it. That's kind of been the watchword by a lot of companies. So I don't know. This whole thing has been kind of just, you don't want to use the word missteps, but just odd. The things that have happened, permits that were needed but weren't acted upon until the last minute. The development of the Arctic Challenger, which is their key oil containment or emergency containment vessel.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't ready on time, so they weren't able to actually do any drilling But the federal government did allow them to do what I mentioned earlier is the
shallow, put the collars on at the top of the well, sort of, yeah.
Yeah, just kind of start the well, basically.
Yeah, yeah. Boy. And here we are with the big rig grounded just on an island down in the Gulf of Alaska, let alone all the way up in the Arctic. This is going to make people scratch their heads and wonder what's the right thing. John Sullivan in Houston, Texas, with Energy Intelligence, senior reporter there. Thanks very much for joining us, John.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I want to get a couple of voices in here who know the situation well. Jerry Balinson is with us, deputy editor for Popular Mechanics. He spent 4 days on the rig that is now grounded off of Kodiak Island in the Arctic Ocean in October of last year. He joins us today from New York. Jerry, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
And Lois Epstein joins us from Alaska, Anchorage, Alaska. She's the Arctic Program Director for the Wilderness Society. Lois, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
What are you thinking as you look at this rig, up on the rocks there in those wild seas south of Anchorage, let alone in the Arctic, Lois?
Boy, you know, nature always wins in Alaska, and this is a great demonstration of that. While you have been talking with others about Shell's record, my position as an engineer and someone who's been working on this industry for quite a few decades now, let's say two, and is that there's always the unexpected, and in the Arctic, that's magnified. Alaska in general has some really bad weather. In the Arctic, we have, in addition to winds and fog and some darkness, we also have ice to deal with. Everything's new for Shell and others. So no matter how technically capable you are, you're going to confront some surprises. So I think that there was a lot of hubris out there, a lot in the industry. A lot of folks felt that they could do the drilling because the drilling's, you know, not particularly deep in the Arctic, but there's so much else involved that they really probably went too far out on the limb. And I think at this point, people are reevaluating that question.
Lois, we heard the Shell spokesman say earlier that they've already done successful offshore drilling off Alaska. So what's the difference?
Well, you know, they did it a couple of decades ago, but there aren't a lot of wells. There are tens of thousands of wells in the Gulf of Mexico. In the Arctic and the Beaufort Sea, we have about 30 wells, and that's not just by Shell. In the Chukchi Sea, which is larger than the state of California, there's only been 5 wells. So, you know, if you're very careful, maybe you won't have a problem, but, you know, this incident shows that even when they were trying and under enormous scrutiny, they still had plenty of problems, and they haven't been able to explain away those problems, and any statement about your safety record is really called into question when you look at what happened this year.
Jerry Balinson, Jerry in New York with Popular Mechanics, you were out on this one, the Kulik in October. Where was it when you were on it, Jerry, and what are you thinking as you see these images of it up on the rocks now?
Well, it was on in the Beaufort Sea, about a dozen miles offshore, not too far really from Prudhoe Bay. And, you know, the underlying geology of the Great North Slope oil field extends out under the ocean, which is why there's, you know, a lot of excitement about the Beaufort and even more about the Chukchi Sea, which, as you say, is to the west. I was there at the very end of the season when drilling was finishing up, and they were trying to demobilize the rig. And one of the things that Shell has said repeatedly over the last couple of years, and Lois was just referring to this, is that drilling the wells is easy. They have emphasized that. They're shallow wells that are similar to the kinds of wells Shell says that they drilled in the Gulf of Mexico in the 1970s. But then they always say the logistics are the hard part. But the logistics, you know, really matter.
Are everything. Yeah.
In the Arctic, you just expect delays, you expect things to go wrong. I mean, one of the things that people I've spoken to in Alaska will say is that, you know, this was a big storm in the Gulf of Alaska, but this is, you know, the Gulf of Alaska in winter. It's not that unusual. And the people who live in the North Slope, the Inupiaq Eskimos, say the same thing. You know, you just don't know. I mean, I've been in meetings with them in Shell where they say, you know, you just don't know what it's like. I mean, 70-mile-an-hour winds, negative 50-degree temperatures, how are you going to deal with that?
And we're not talking about flipping a kayak here. We're talking about a grounded oil rig.
Right. I mean, this oil rig, you know, it's extremely interesting, and it's pretty much unique. There's just one other rig that's really like this in the world. Its Achilles heel is being towed. It spent its entire life in the Arctic, and every year they would tow it behind Herschel Island in the Mackenzie Bay, which is Canada side, and just freeze it into the pack ice.
Mm-hmm.
Most ships, you know, will splinter in those conditions, but the Kulik is really fine at being frozen to pack ice. It's a very hardy vessel.
3-inch steel walls, I think I read in your report,
towing it, it's a bobbing cork. I mean, it's just nobody was looking forward to towing it. Everyone was making jokes about having enough seasickness medication with them. They just really don't like taking this into the open seas. Of course, you have to if you're going to bring it to Seattle to have major renovations done.
Jerry, hold the thought there. We've had so many callers coming in here, and it's been too interesting to break away, but I want to begin to bring them in. Let's go down Gulf of Mexico way, where they've got some troubled experience on this front. New Orleans, Allison is calling. Allison, thank you. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to say I agree completely with Lois. Was that her name?
Yes.
The hubris of humanity. And I can't believe that they keep saying, if something happens. She also said nature always wins, which is exactly true. You can't say if something happens. It's more like when something happens. And I also want to say, is nothing sacred? We're not going to have any wildlife to offer our children to see except for what's in SeaWorld and zoos.
And what do you say to people who say, Allison, we need the energy, we need the oil?
I say, why isn't the concentration on alternate forms of energy? I mean, couldn't we have had electric cars in the Carter administration? I think I heard that somewhere. And also, if we don't learn from history, aren't we bound to keep repeating it over and over and over again?
Yeah, $4 billion plus spent just by Shell, just on this effort, so far unsuccessful to get into the Arctic. Allison, point taken there from New Orleans on the rim of the Gulf, where everything happened in 2010. Lois, is this just going to roll ahead anyway? Is it got that kind of head of steam? The Obama administration has been open to offshore drilling.
Yes. But, and that's the key point, they now have a little bit of experience about what the problems can be. I think certainly Shell's financial decision makers are beginning to realize, and some of the banks have decided that they're not going to be funding offshore drilling. One European bank has done that, Lloyd's of London. There's a lot of questions still out there. I don't think this is a done deal by any means.
Lois Epstein, please stand by in Anchorage. We have to take a little break here. Jerry, we want to come back and look at, and Lois, what it might look like if there were a spill in the Arctic, what that kind of cleanup might look like. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the big oil rig run aground in Alaska and the future of oil drilling in the Arctic, whether, when, and how it might be safely done. Jerry Balinson joins us, deputy editor at Popular Mechanics. He spent several days on the Kulik earlier this year. We'll ask him more about that. Lois Epstein is with us from Alaska, Anchorage, Arctic Program Director for the Wilderness Society, an engineer herself who's testified on Arctic and oil drilling over the years. Jerry, when you were up there, just tell us what it looks like. Is this half a football field wide? It's kind of circular? What's the scale of this thing? What's it look like when you're on it?
Well, it is, when you come in by helicopter, and that's how you fly in, it seems like a kind of a small bobbing, almost a bowling pin on an island in the sea. But once you land, it's a round rig. It's one of the very few, maybe the only one in the world that is a round floating offshore rig. The derrick is 160 feet tall off of the drilling floor. It's sort of a labyrinth inside. It was built in 1982 and 83 in Japan. And as you go through, you see this old wood paneling and, you know, fresh orange and green sofas from the 70s and 80s.
It's kind of an old rig, isn't it?
Perfectly preserved, but in great shape. I mean, somebody on the rig told me it was like finding a perfect 1969 Camaro in a barn somewhere.
Okay.
The people, I have to, there were a couple points that I thought, you know, I haven't really heard come out that I think might be important to point out. First of all, you know, Shell has the permits more or less in place and is planning to drill again this summer.
Mm-hmm.
If the Kulik is damaged, that is almost impossible that that would happen. The Discoverer, which is actually the, you know, drilling in the Chukchi, which Shell is even more excited about,
mm-hmm.
Its permits rely on the Kulik being there as a backup rig.
Mm-hmm.
So in all cases, Shell's committed to having two functioning rigs up in the Arctic so that if there was a blowout, as there was in the Gulf of Mexico, the other rig would be able to come in and drill a relief well.
Mm-hmm.
If the Kulik were not able to go up there this summer, they could try to get another rig up there, but there are a lot of regulatory hurdles to do that. So in the next few days or weeks, we'll kind of find out what shape the Kulik is in, but that'll really, you know, tell us whether Shell is going forward in 2013.
Lois, describe for us the concern if they're when they're exploring, they only drill in the summer. But if they find oil, and presumably sooner or later they would, then the drilling becomes year-round because you're plugged into the ocean floor and you're pumping. As I understand, the pipeline that gets so much attention, I worked on it myself, that comes down through Alaska, needs more oil to keep functioning, and they don't have enough off the North Slope at this point. I don't know. You tell us. But if they start pumping out of the Arctic waters there and they get a blowout or a spill, and summer, winter, what's the challenge of cleanup like there? We saw how hard it was in the Gulf of Mexico in open water and warm. What are the special challenges if they did run into an emergency in the Arctic, Lois?
Well, a quick point about the Trans-Alaska pipeline. Actually, there's been a lot of hype about the decreased amount of oil. There are technical ways of dealing with that and upgrading the pipeline. Those measures are likely to be implemented because of the existing known reserves on the North Slope and the ownership of the pipline. They have every bit
incentive,
of financial interest to ensure it keeps going.
Mm-hmm.
But on your question, in terms of the cleanup, in the Gulf of Mexico, we saw approximately 3% of the oil being recovered. People don't know that. A lot of it goes into the air. It goes into the water. Certainly very, very sensitive waters in the Arctic, where you have marine mammals that are relied on by Arctic peoples for an enormous percentage of their food over the year. They rely on the fish. This is an area where it's very expensive to get other kinds of foods, and people don't really want other kinds of foods. This is part of their cultural traditions. But in terms of what you have to do, cleanup is not a good thing to rely on in any case. It's not saying don't do it, but what you have is once you have oil under or near ice, it's impossible to recover, and that's been shown to be the case in broken ice. You just can't do any sort of meaningful recovery. You also have situations where it's just hard to get the people in place because there's so few land-based infrastructure. Right now, mm-hmm. in Barrow, there's maybe two hotels in existence, and they're being occupied by the Shell and its contractors. If you had a cleanup situation, you're going to need a lot more people. You're going to need a lot more locations.
A lot more equipment. I mean, never mind the hotel space, but yeah, sure, as simple as that. I mean, I'm reading here, Jerry, this is in The Economist. They said, talking about controlled oil spills off Norway, suggesting that if there were a spill, it would coat the underside of the sea ice, and then more ice would form under that and make a kind of ice-oil sandwich, kind of reverse Oreo here. And Shell apparently has said that there's really no way to track it, but they could track it, I guess, and that oil sandwich and then burn it as it drifted south and melted. Is that really feasible?
Well, I think what Lois is saying is basically correct, that in any situation, an oil spill cleanup is the last thing you want to do. It's sort of there's a lot of focus on it, but that implies a huge, you know, long series of really serious failures. In fact, there was this testing by, you know, SINTEF is the name of this organization that has done some of these tests in Norway. In situ burning was the most effective, but there's nothing that's all that effective. I mean, Shell has invested a huge amount of money and manpower to stage oil spill response vessels around the Kulik and the Discoverer. So they've really done, I think, a very good job in trying to do that.
What about just getting down there to cap a well if it blew out when it was frozen over in the winter? How would you even do that? Is this back to the submarine scenario we heard about earlier? Hard to picture.
It really is. I mean, one thing, I have to, just to kind of give Shell the due a little bit. First, you know, I should mention that, you know, when I was on the rig, I found a lot of very thoughtful, careful people who were really proud of the efforts they were making to try to protect the environment.
Yeah.
But Shell itself will say that they're not prepared to produce oil out of these wells. I mean, if they found oil, that would be a decade away, and yeah, they'd have to invent a lot of technology to do it. There is one example from elsewhere in the world that's useful. Norway has a huge natural gas project called Snøhvit, which is actually north of the Arctic Circle, and all the infrastructure is under the ice. It's all along the sea floor.
Mm-hmm.
But if there were an oil spill in a situation like that, it would be pretty devastating. I was there's a great whale biologist who lives in Barrow whose name is Craig George, and he works very closely with the Inupiaq community there. And their biggest concern would be an oil spill under the ice. The oil would be likely to collect in the leads or channels that open up as the ice starts to break up in the spring.
Right.
And those are the same leads that that bowhead whales follow in their migratory patterns. And, you know, bowheads are baleen whales with these enormous mouths. They swim with their mouths open to filter the water.
Yeah.
And you could just imagine them ingesting vast amounts of oil. So I think everyone, including Shell, would say, an oil spill in that scenario would be, devastating. And it's certainly the primary concern for people who live up there.
Let's go to Wilson, calling from New Orleans again. Wilson, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have 30 years of marine engineering experience in the engine rooms on ships at sea.
Okay.
I can't speak to this oil drilling, but my entire career has been spent preventing engine room failures.
Our ears are wide open. What do you think about all this?
Well, failures are going to happen, and they have to be anticipated. It is extremely disconcerting to me that Shell Oil would transit the Gulf of Alaska in late December. I hear it's going to take 3 weeks to do that. They should have left the drill site 2 months earlier.
Mm-hmm.
To me, this shows that Shell Oil's bottom line is not safety, but profits. And this is the same mentality that was shown on the Deepwater Horizon drill rig.
I did wonder about that myself, Wilson, and you've got the experience, but I was thinking, why now? And I really do wonder, I mean, Jerry, what's that about? Why would they be taking it on such a long journey in the very sort of, heart of winter here? Were they trying to get out of Alaska for tax reasons before January 1 or something? Why now?
It's a good question. They wouldn't. Another related question that I have is why the IVIC was the only ship towing the Kulik, because that rig can be towed by two ships at the same time, and in heavy seas, it's just a question I haven't been able to ask Shell yet of why the IVIC was alone out there. They're trying to get the rig down to Seattle for maintenance and further sort of improvements to it. The timing does, if you wind back the tape,
yeah,
the whole summer was just one mishap after another for Shell. They didn't finally get to start drilling with the Kulik until October 3rd.
Yeah.
One reason for that is they have an agreement not to drill during the whaling season for some of the villages that are in the Beaufort.
Mm-hmm.
And they had thought that, they would be able to get out of the Arctic theater by the time the ice came, which they more or less did.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was just not enough attention paid on the tow down to Seattle, as the caller is saying. One thing that I really noticed was when I was on that rig, as I said, people were very conscientious. They were really careful, wanting to be careful about wildlife and so on. They were almost entirely Southerners. Everyone on board had a Louisiana accent.
Okay.
And I have to kind of wonder, I mean, there were certain things that happened. For instance, their helicopters didn't have de-icing capabilities. They'd been brought up from the Gulf of Mexico. And to people who live on the North Slope, that was just kind of an astonishing oversight. And I have no real evidence for this, but I'm kind of wondering if they, while focusing so much on the drilling, have underestimated how much they have to think about Arctic and really far northern conditions.
Well, I can't understand helicopters without de-icing. On the other hand, there's a lot of Southerners with a lot of experience up there. I mean, when I worked up there, it seemed like everybody's from Oklahoma, Texas, Louisiana. It's not as though there aren't Southerners who've worked in Alaskan oil for a long time, but here we are. Joe in Framingham, Massachusetts. Joe, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, in the talking about risk and reward in a larger context, mm-hmm. when you look at the oil exploration, the EPA, I believe, has granted something like 1,500 exemptions to aquifers across the United States, and there's something like 100 drinking water aquifers that have been written off.
What are you talking about? In terms of pipelines or fracking or what?
No, just in fracking. But if you look at oil and gas, mm-hmm. all of these things have risk and reward.
Yes.
And if you think about it, you know, in the larger context, you know, if we lose all of our drinking water supply in the United States, especially in places where there's droughts, you know, all of these things have risk, and it's a question of do you want to lose your drinking supply?
So you'd rather take the risk up in the Arctic and let the bowhead whales fend for themselves than take it on top of your aquifer, Joe?
No, but it's just putting all of these things in perspective.
Yeah, yeah.
And thinking about the fact that, you know, we're wildly allowing all of these aquifers to be lost. And
well,
eventually, you know, we may have the gas, but water may become so expensive that, you know, it's just a context and a thought process.
I appreciate your call, Joe. Lois, how about it? There's always risk attached here. If we're going to have aquifers at risk in the heavily populated parts of the United States, or even out in the Great Plains, Joe's kind of suggesting, you know, maybe this is the less risky of options if you're looking at those two.
Well, I think as an Alaskan, challenge that in the details, but I think the bigger question is, you know, how are we going to supply our energy needs? And the situation right now is with shale oil, which is a potential source of crude in Alaska and filling the pipeline that's actively going on in areas that are much less sensitive than the offshore and certainly less sensitive than areas like the Arctic Refuge. You know, we can meet our energy needs through additional development of resources in less sensitive areas. We can meet it through efficiency and renewables. You know, the trend lines for the United States now are very good. We're not desperate. We're smart people. We need to protect the special places, and I think that's something that Americans would support in general.
Danny in Grand Isle, Louisiana, way out there on the tip. Out in oil country. Danny, thanks for calling. You're on.
Oh, yeah, thank you. I've been listening to the whole discussion, and I kind of lived through the BP incident here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know that we always learn from our mistakes, but I think a point should be made. There's really no such thing as true redundancy, even in the oil patch. So when you talk about safety and mechanical failure,
yeah.
It happens all the time. We live down here, helicopters crash, boats run aground, so we shouldn't kid ourselves. We take it up to an Arctic environment. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And then my way of looking at it, the consequences or the remediation is just so much harder because Mother Nature there is just, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, that is the truth. Danny, I appreciate...
Remote location as well.
Very remote, very cold and all the rest. Danny, appreciate your witness there. Jerry, what do you think? Lois points out, everybody talks about the, you know, energy boom we're having in the lower 48. Does it slowly pull the plug on Shell here, or did you sense full determination to go ahead and drill in the Arctic?
Well, you know, of course, I'm not a pundit. I'm not going to
give my opinion
about
you were with
they
them.
Should. But what Shell, you know, I asked that question a number of times because you kind of start hearing rumblings in the industry that other companies like ConocoPhillips and that, you know, was planning to drill as early as 2014 is, you know, well, I was glad it's not them that having all these problems.
Yeah.
What Shell, at least publicly, you said in private conversations too, what those executives have said is that they don't know what the price of oil will be this summer or next year, but they know 10 or 20 years from now what it'll be.
So the motivation is still there. Jerry Balinson, Popular Mechanics, thank you so much. Lois Epstein, with the Wilderness Society in Anchorage. Thanks to you as well and all our guests this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.